From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what should be done with Michigan's 350 juvenile lifers? The state Supreme Court will decide following an important U.S. Supreme Court ruling.
The question is, this a decision that needs to be applied retroactively to cases that, you know, some of them go back to the early 1960s, and do those juvenile lifers get resentenced?
As some Americans celebrate getting health coverage through Obamacare, what about some small businesses?
I mean, they're seeing increases that are just coming out of the blue and really hitting them in the head.
What can Detroit learn from New Orleans as it rebuilds from Hurricane Katrina?
I had laid out some of the lessons in the story a little bit more explicitly that were given to me by planners and people who thought heavily about New Orleans, that you need time.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for joining us on this Thursday. After Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, there was a short-lived proposal to ban rebuilding in the most damaged neighborhoods. The purpose was to downsize New Orleans in a strategic manner. But that initial proposal was met with an outcry of anger, and it was quickly shot down. Today, what can Detroit learn from New Orleans' efforts to rebuild strategically post-Katrina? And then Daniel Howes looks at what the ACA has meant for one small Michigan business. But first, life without parole used to be the automatic sentence for juveniles who were tried as adults and convicted of first-degree murder. Well, that was until 2012, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that automatic life without parole for juveniles was unconstitutional. But a question remains. What should happen to the more than 350 juvenile lifers here in Michigan who were sent to prison before this decision? The Michigan Supreme Court heard arguments on that question today, and Lansing Bureau Chief of the Michigan Public Radio Network, Rick Pluta, was in the courtroom. Hey, Rick.
Hi, Cindy.
So let's go back a bit. Take us back to that 2012 U.S. Supreme Court decision and tell us exactly what it said.
Well, the decision was Miller versus Alabama, and what the United States Supreme Court said was that adult time for adult crime laws like Michigan's that have mandatory sentences didn't take into account the fact that teenagers are not mini adults, that they have different ways of thinking, of processing things. They're motivated differently. And at least at the sentencing stage, that once the decision had been made to try them as adults, they still have to be sentenced with an eye toward the fact that they are juveniles with hearings that take into account their life circumstances, you know, whether they were raised in situations of abuse and neglect, for example, and also how culpable they were in the crime, and in this case, in the case of Michigan, first-degree murder.
So this raises this big question, and that is, should the 350-some juvenile lifers in Michigan be resentenced? Basically, should this Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decision be applied retroactively?
Exactly. And in current cases going forward, that juveniles who are convicted of first-degree murder will get these hearings. And we have had, since the Miller decision, almost two dozen juveniles, 23, who have actually been sentenced to life without parole with a hearing. But the question is this a decision that needs to be applied retroactively to cases that, you know, some of them go back to the early 1960s, and do those juvenile lifers get resentenced? And that's what the three cases that were before the Michigan Supreme Court today were all about.
So what did we hear in court? Let's start with the state. What are they arguing?
The state says that the Miller decision, the U.S. Supreme Court decision, is not applied retroactively because it's basically a process decision, that juvenile lifers currently serving weren't denied a fair trial, that their guilt or innocence is not in question. I should say their guilt is not in question. What they were denied, so to speak, was something that was procedural. And the Supreme Court did not say that juveniles cannot be sentenced to life without parole. It just said, if you're going to do it, here's how you have to go about it. And that's why the state is arguing that this is a process decision, that there will still be juveniles sentenced to life without parole. And so, therefore, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to go back and apply all of these decisions retroactively, induct that level of instability into the system, deny the finality to the survivors of murder victims that they thought had been guaranteed by the state. And so that's basically the state's position on this question of retroactivity.
And then what about those representing these juvenile lifers? What did we hear from them?
They say that this is a substantive decision, a watershed decision, one that actually should alter how sentences are handled in the state of Michigan, that this was, if this was a violation of the Eighth Amendment going forward, then it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment for the 350-plus juvenile lifers who are currently serving, and they deserve to be resentenced, and some of them at least be handed an opportunity at parole one day.
And what kind of questions did the justices serve up?
They were very, very focused on this question of whether it's a process question, whether this was a process decision or a substantive decision. And as you know, can tell even from our conversation that it's a very nuanced conversation. There are a lot of fine lines that need to be drawn. And so really they return to that time and time again with the whole plethora of attorneys who appeared before them in these three cases saying, explain to me what you think a process decision is versus a substantive legal ruling by the court. And that certainly seems to be a lot of what this case is going to turn on. I should point out that there were a couple of other questions that the court was addressing as well. One is the issue of whether or not aiders and abettors should ever even be subject to the possibility of life without parole, that if you did not actually pull the trigger, wield the weapon, that you would only face at a maximum parolable life. And what the prosecutor's side argued on that is, in Michigan, we don't make that distinction. If you participated in a murder, even in sort of an ancillary fashion, you are considered every bit as culpable as the person who actually physically committed the murder. And the side arguing for defendants said, but in the case of juveniles, we should make a distinction. So that was one of the questions. And also the state appellate defender's office also suggested that there should be some kind of a cutoff, maybe the age of 14, maybe the age of 15, a point at which a juvenile would never be subject to life without parole.
Are we seeing other states around the union dealing with this question, Rick, since the U.S. Supreme Court decision came down?
Oh, sure. The Miller decision affected sentencing in at least 29 states that we know of, but each state gets to decide individually how they're going to do it as long as they stay within the parameters set by the Supreme Court. So we've seen some states that have simply abolished life without parole for juveniles. In other cases, California, for example, allows inmates sentenced to life without parole as juveniles to petition for a sentence review. Mississippi, courts there have ruled that the decision is retroactive. In Minnesota, courts have ruled that it's not retroactive. So there's really no uniform way of dealing with this. And we've seen that the federal correction system has taken the position that the Miller decision regarding life without parole sentences is retroactive. And so federal inmates sentenced to life without parole as juveniles get a hearing.
Rick, as you've covered this story and leading up to today's session before the state Supreme Court, the victim side is something that has to be considered here. And you spoke with a woman whose brother was murdered by a 16-year-old and a 19-year-old. What did she have to say to you about all of this?
Jody Robinson, I spoke with her and her father, and quite simply, they feel betrayed that this is even a question. They thought that they had finality, that they'd closed the door on this, that the next step in the healing process was going to be resuming thinking about their son and brother in terms of the way he lived his life as opposed to the way that it was ended. And every time this question comes up again, then they return to the fact that he was murdered, and now they're very concerned that they're going to be, you know, reliving this periodically with a notice in the mail that a parole hearing is going to be held.
So, Rick, if the court rules that these juvenile lifers do indeed deserve to be resentenced, do we have any idea how exactly that would work?
How exactly it would work? No. Obviously, you know, the state corrections department is aware that it's a possibility, but it would depend on what the state Supreme Court rules in this case, of course. And we should point out there's also sort of a parallel federal case. It's in the Detroit U.S. District Court. And it was originally a challenge to the juvenile lifer law, a lot like the Miller challenge. And once that decision came down, Judge O'Mara in that case basically turned it into a case about monitoring whether or not Michigan is actually complying with the ruling. And Judge O'Mara ruled back in November that Michigan's unparolable juvenile lifers are all now eligible for parole, that they will get parole hearings. That decision was appealed by the state attorney general, and it's been stayed while it's before the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. So there's a wide range of possibilities in terms of how juvenile lifers would get resentenced should that actually be what the Supreme Court orders.
So any idea when we would get a ruling from the high court?
Well, controversial issues like this can hang out till the end of the term. As you can imagine, they're complex. There's a lot to talk about. There will be a straw vote among the justices, and one of the justices in the majority on that vote will be assigned the task of writing an opinion. That'll be circulated. Justices will respond to it, give their feedback, and they'll try and craft something. There's no deadline for when it has to happen except before the end of the Supreme Court session later on this summer.
Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, Rick Pluta. Thanks so much, Rick.
My pleasure, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's little question that the Affordable Care Act is a game changer for Americans who had jobs where no insurance was available from the employer, or who had pre-existing conditions, or whose incomes didn't qualify them for Medicaid but couldn't afford to buy health coverage with what they were making. But as the health care picture brightens for these Americans, there are others who are frankly sick of the ACA and the upheaval that it has brought into their lives. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House took a look at what the ACA has meant for a typical small Michigan business. Daniel, tell us about American Gear and Engineering. That's the company you profile in today's column in the news.
Yeah, it's a little company in Westland, Michigan, and owned and run by a guy named Jeff Emerson. And they started looking at their insurance because it was time for renewal. And essentially, to cut to the chase, to keep the same kind of coverage that they had for their 47 employees starting this summer, I think June 1st, they were going to end up having to pay an additional $107,000 and change for their employees, which on a company of his size would have come pretty close probably to erasing his bottom line. And that's in a fairly decent economy for little gear shops like his. And so essentially they were faced with a choice. Do they pay that and run that risk, or do they offload some of the costs? Well, they came to the conclusion that they couldn't maintain the policies that they had with the kind of deductibles and copays that they had and force all of that money off onto their employees. So what they've decided to do, and what they're in the process of deciding to do, I should say, is go with a less generous plan that raises copays and out-of-pocket expenses for their employees and their families to essentially kind of keep their bill even. But it's a very difficult process. He's also come to the realization that he's paying about $14,000 in fees, most of which go to the federal government, which goes into a fund that will be used to backstop insurance companies if they lose money, which is, some people talk about it as a backdoor bailout to the health insurance company, and guys like Jeff are essentially footing that bill. They showed me some bills that they received on these kinds of fees that went, they jumped, I don't know, a couple hundred bucks to $1,200 from December to January. So, I mean, they're seeing increases that are just coming out of the blue and really hitting them in the head.
And what happens when he calls anybody for clarification, help, whatever.
Well, he's a guy who is not afraid to get on the phone and call his elected leaders. And the story he tells is he called Senator Stabenow's office, and it went back and forth. And at one point, the person hung up on him. His controller sent emails to Senator Levin's office, and the response was, "Well, we have to check into this." Which is a little head scratching because, you know, we are in the month of the fourth anniversary of the signing of the Affordable Care Act. And you've got members of the president's party in the Senate still saying, well, we didn't know that was going to impact employers this way. I called the attorney general's office in Michigan and basically said, you know, that's not our bailiwick. We really can't do much about it. Called the governor's office a couple of times, talked to them. The response was, well, number one, the governor doesn't support Obamacare. And number two, he's a Republican and the Democrats don't care what he thinks anyway. So, the bottom line is there's not a lot of relief or sympathy that a guy like this is able to get. And as he pointed out to me, even if you delay, even because of some of these serial delays that the Obama administration is doing to its own law, that doesn't really help him because in his case, the Blue Care Network that his company had policy had been using disappears June 1st. So and we've heard this before, the insurance companies are already, you know, have already set this whole thing in motion, and they're moving down the road here. And so he's trying to figure out a way to deal with this. This is a small company, small business owner, had a lot of employees that have been with him since they were teenagers. And as he pointed out to me, you know, they came here, you know, 15 years ago and making $6 and $7 an hour. Now some of these guys are making $22, $24 an hour. They're doing well. They're part of the family. I know their spouses. I know their kids. This is important to me. And not just to offload it, or as some guys are doing, saying, oh, here's $500 or here's $1,000, now go out and get your own. I'm not going to do it anymore. And the numbers and the increase, I think what's really shocking is the increases that are coming to these companies and how they're having to essentially trade off policies to keep their health care spend roughly acceptable. I mean, I think some people know that there's going to be increases, but these increases, I mean, $107,000 in your spend in 1 year is remarkable.
And to those who say, well, the people who are flinching and reeling with these higher costs had a pretty good ride with their health coverage while so many other Americans were left out in the cold, and that really that the benefit for all Americans needs to trump an individual's problems.
Well, you know, we're certainly familiar with that argument, but you know, as he said to me, he said, there's a lot fewer regular Joes that are going to be around to pay the bills, and this is all predicated on the fact that people are working and they're able to pay the premiums and to provide for other people. And this is all happening at a time where there's continues to be uncertainty in the marketplace about what business costs are going to be. And I think what we see from the administration and their supporters is kind of a dismissal of that as an issue. But you sit and talk to a guy like Jeff, or you talk to other business people, or you look at the jobs numbers, and you realize that while the moving targets of Obamacare probably aren't the sole reason for slow economic growth, they've got to be a contributing factor because people don't know what their costs are going to be. And now they've pushed it out a couple more years, so we continue this uncertainty and not really knowing how these things are going to play out because the numbers are going to change every year.
Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist with the view from the world of the small business person on the Affordable Care Act. Daniel, thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
My failure.
My divorce. My divorce.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
And now a story of failure from Failure Lab in Grand Rapids. Here's Ellie Rogers.
Hello, I'm Ellie. I'm fairly new to West Michigan, and I'm kind of thinking about whether or not this was the best way to make my debut. But it's too late to go back, so. I don't know if life can ever prepare you to start from scratch, all alone, well into adulthood, with not much more than a Dyson. What did I do wrong? What could have I done differently? These are questions most of us probably ask ourselves before we go to bed at night. But coming here is much more daunting of a process. On one hand, if I'm too serious, you're all going to feel like you're stuck in the middle of some sort of 12-step program. But if I'm flippant, then we miss out on one of life's most teachable moments, failure. My teachable moment, my failure, is my divorce. I've had a lot of successes in my life. I've overcome a lot of hardships. I have a kick-ass credit score and no criminal record. But my divorce is one mess that I can't clean up. Not for myself, not for my ex, not for our friends and family, but most importantly, I haven't been able to clean it up for my daughter. My daughter is adorable. She's smart and compassionate and fun. She sings in the shower and she hums when she plays. And I love being her mom and all my mom idiosyncrasies that go along with it. I'm notoriously neurotic about everything that she eats. Before anyone comes over to my house, we have a pre-planning session. I let them know what world of make-believe they'll be entering, and they always comply. Every word that comes out of my mouth is meaningful as I try to help her shape her identity so she can be successful and happy. And we're as close as they come. She writes me love notes on my iPhone. We hold hands wherever we go. We cuddle on the couch. We have I love you more contests every time we talk. And as strong as my relationship is with her, my relationship with her dad is a mess. And it makes me cringe to think that the two people that love her the most and the two people who she loves the most are causing her stress and anxiety. We have an order that meticulously outlines our parenting time down to the minute. There's absolutely no room for flexibility. All of our communication has to go through a portal that's built specifically for the most dysfunctional divorcees. You can't erase anything you write, and there's third-party access for therapists and litigators. It has a tone meter to let you know if you're getting a little bit nasty. I would describe the whole situation as both pathetic and intriguing. The type of fodder that would be perfect for a reality TV show, except it's not, because it's about my daughter. And I'm her mom, and I'll do anything I can to fix it. And I have made the largest sacrifices of time and money. I found the best therapist and the best mediator. I got a court order to bind us to use those professionals. I've reached out to friends and family and tarot card readers and psychics. And I might even admit I called a radio talk show once. And that's the tip of the iceberg. For the last 7 years, I feel like I've been trapped in a crowded, hot waiting room, waiting for some sort of diagnosis. You know it's just going to go from bad to worse, and just when you're least expecting it, they pipe in Kenny G. So rewind. How did I get to this place? The separation was fairly uneventful. It certainly wasn't happy, but it wasn't particularly dramatic. I had no ill will towards my husband at the time, and I don't think he had any ill will towards me. Quite the opposite, in fact. I felt that the divorce was fair, was mostly mediated, if not generous. I left him with our gorgeous house and most of the things in it. And I started over from scratch. I bought a home, alone, and I thought I was going to do the superwoman lifestyle thing. And I did it. I single-mommed it. I had my own successful business for 5 years. And when my daughter entered kindergarten, I started a rigorous grad school program. I took 19 credits, statistics, finance, accounting, and I still got that little girl on the bus at 7 a.m. every day, fed, rested, and happy. I could do it all. I have success in so many aspects of my life, but this divorce is a barrage of sticking points, neglected agreements, ignored efforts, until I found myself all the way into divorce hell, which was fairly recent, actually. If you'd like to go on a journey with me, I'll take you there. Divorce hell is looking at your finances over the last year and realizing you've committed 6 months of pay to try to fix the situation with child support, therapy, mediation, and litigation, yet you're still forced to go before a judge to make the most basic parenting decisions. It just so happened that our hearing date was on April Fool's Day. About an hour into it, my attorney realized, and so did I, that the judge wasn't quite certain what the hearing was about. It would be fair to say that I spent five figures to get to that hearing date. My attorney was just getting over a cold, so she lost her voice and couldn't speak. His attorney was ranting like the Fuhrer. I was reviewing an affidavit describing how I parent that was over 60 pages long, single-spaced. If I had to give it a title, I would call it Ellie is the She-Devil. So at this point, a few weeks ago, I was feeling really bitter and justified in blaming other people. We have a broken court system, and we have attorneys that profit on conflict. And I do have some strong feelings about my ex. But if I talked about that, then you guys would feel ripped off because you paid for your tickets. So we have to focus on my failure. And so I started the cathartic process and uncovered a pattern and behavior of my life of doing it all, taking on too much responsibility, spreading myself too thin, picking up the slack for other people, putting the needs of others before the needs of myself. But isn't that what the essence of a mother is? And as I was reflecting, I started to realize that I wasn't alone. I look out and see women everywhere, blessed and cursed with this predisposition to be caregivers. We're all over the place. You can see us. We're running ragged, picking up the slack, doing it all. And you can physically see the evidence of our essence as it gets sucked from us as we try to take care of everybody else. We become deflated, depleted, smaller, and collapsed. Finally, you'll hear somebody make that derogatory comment, gosh, she really let herself go. But they don't finish the statement. She let herself go last because she was busy putting everyone else first. If you listened to our thoughts and got inside our head, you would hear things like, someone's got to get the kids. Someone's got to get the groceries. Someone's got to do the laundry. Someone's got to take the notes for this meeting, even though it's not my role. We are in the constant state of triage, and we lose ourselves in it, trying to hold together our families, our teams, our organizations, and the world. We don't know when to say no. So is doing everything the right thing to do? I don't know. I know it's not just my dilemma. Cleaning up other people's messes. So I think it's both appropriate and symbolic that what I got from my divorce was a Dyson. Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. When Hurricane Katrina slammed into New Orleans on August 29th, 2005, we here in Michigan, along with the rest of America, watched in horror and shock. The scenes of destruction from New Orleans were practically beyond comprehension. It's been 8.5 years since Katrina. New Orleans is still rebuilding, still recovering. And in the process, lessons have been learned that might benefit Detroit as it struggles back from bankruptcy and years of shrinking resources and population. Writer Campbell Robertson's recent piece in the New York Times gives Detroiters and decision makers a lot of food for thought. The title, A Lesson for Detroit in Efforts to Aid a New Orleans Devastated by Katrina. Campbell Robertson, very good to have you on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So you start your piece by describing a community meeting that happened just five mere months after Katrina, where urban planners walked in to present a plan to rebuild New Orleans. Just what did that plan entail?
Well, there were lots of plans going around at the time. There, in November, just a couple months after the storm, the Urban Land Institute put forth a plan that did not quite draw as much attention because it was sort of the plan of the urban planners that would have a lot of changes to the way the city was laid out. But one of the proposals, and it was very conceptual rather than specific, mm-hmm. was that reinvestment in neighborhoods in terms of rebuilding be sort of zoned. In other words, well, we'll start the places that were least damaged and sort of work our way out to the places that were just completely destroyed. The mayor of New Orleans at the time, Ray Nagin, set up a commission, the Bring New Orleans Back commission, that looked on a ton of different issues, education, transportation, all this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their committees, subcommittees, was the urban planning. And they took some of the urban planners' recommendations and put forth their proposal. And by far the most controversial element and what probably killed it in cradle was an idea that, again, neighborhoods, there would be a moratorium on new permits for rebuilding for 4 months, and neighborhoods would have 4 months to sort of come back and put input and, in a sense, justify the reason to spend recovery money in the damaged neighborhoods of the city.
So justify their existence. Should we keep this alive, right?
Well, yes, in the near term. Maybe over the long term you can come back, but you know, we're going to have limited rebuilding money. And if you can't really justify not enough people coming back, you can't really give a reason, not enough interest from residents, we'll buy out the residents and possibly, I mean, there are a number of things that could be done, but mm-hmm. one option was turn them over to green space. And a map ran on the front page of the Times-Picayune that morning, the paper here, that showed big green dots over certain neighborhoods. Ooh. And while that was really conceptual, that map was just, when it looked like that, it was so stark that the reaction was swift and the plan went down.
And it strikes me that these planners looked at this as, gosh, kind of a silver bullet. Let's solve a lot of New Orleans problems as we rebuild from Katrina, because wasn't that idea of downsizing something that was on minds anyway, because the city had a smaller population but a larger footprint than 50 years earlier?
It's funny. It really wasn't, though. New Orleans was headed to be a smaller version of Detroit. In mm-hmm. 1960, the population was about 620,000. Even before the storm, it had already shrunk to 400,000+ and was a trajectory to keep shrinking. There were no major economic drivers other than tourism. Mm. And so there were all these talks about how to fix the city, but downsizing really was not discussed because most cities, until they're faced with a disaster, don't have these discussions.
Sure.
Which, you know, if I had laid out some of the lessons in the story a little bit more explicitly, that were given to me by planners and people who thought heavily about New Orleans, it's that you need time. And to try to do this immediately after disaster, which is often how it's done, after a flood, after a fire, after tornado. Birmingham is rebuilding neighborhoods after the tornadoes
right.
a couple of years ago. They were just trying to fix a lot of problems in a very short amount of time.
Hit the reset button. And it seems that what the planners saw then as a silver bullet to them looked like what to residents? Racism?
Certainly racism. I mean, you know, in defense of the planners, I think a lot of them really thought this was a reasonable and fair way to rebuild the city and wouldn't leave people stranded in neighborhoods off with no services. Obviously, flood risk was an issue. Some of these neighborhoods were built, you know, not all of New Orleans is below sea level, contrary to public perception, but some of it is, a lot of it is. And so they were thinking this is a logical way back. Well, residents were, A, seeing that they weren't involved in the process. They were saying that this mainly came from a lot of the faces associated with white, and there were certainly people saying publicly at the time, oh, we need to remake our city, even along demographic lines, which translates to a lot of these residents, oh, we want to remake this into a wider, richer city.
Boy, and I can only imagine a lot of black residents probably had a real distrustful view of City Hall after that.
Well, and that's the problem, because that sort of poisoned so much going forward. education reform, sort of rethinking the public housing, you know, all these discussions going forward, you know, because of that initial plan and because it was not thought through and nobody, you know, if I will use the generous interpretation, nobody really thought through the optics of what they were saying.
There you go.
When they planned to shrink the city and mostly the black parts of the city, that, you know, all of the discussions forward were immediately, it started from a level of deep, 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 and I would think somewhat justifiable mistrust. And it made the recovery, in some ways, it stalled discussions that could have been a lot more fruitful had everybody come in feeling like everyone had stakes and everyone was being listened to equally.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with writer Campbell Robertson. His recent piece in the New York Times entitled A Lesson for Detroit in Efforts to Aid in New Orleans Devastated by Katrina. So this resizing silver bullet plan goes away quickly. Then how would you characterize the rebuilding that has followed since then?
Well, see, and that's where some of the initial downsizers still think that the idea was had merit. Because it was very uneven, and it was even based on how wealthy a neighborhood was before the storm. Obviously, a bunch of private insurance money comes in, and neighborhood's going to come back more quickly. The government aid programs that were designed to help people rebuild were really flawed, and so some places really, really stalled. Neighborhoods that were already kind of in a downward trajectory before the storm only continued afterwards. And to this day, it's been very uneven. From neighborhood to neighborhood. Now, there's some neighborhoods. There's a neighborhood called Broadmoor, very very diverse, black residents, white residents, poor, rich. And that was right under one of those green dots. And that has just been an amazing success story for the city. Very active, very high community engagement, and a shot back. Other areas have been slower. But I think what even people involved in those initial plans admit, they underestimated how much people wanted to come back. And that's a huge difference with Detroit. We're talking a city where hundreds of thousands of people were just hungry to get back to their homes.
Now, you describe people living on couches or guest bedrooms in Texas. Just, you know, how do we get back to New Orleans? When can we do that? Yeah.
Within weeks of the storms, meeting in church basements in Baton Rouge and saying, how can we rebuild? And those plans to shrink the city just didn't understand or underestimated or ignored that desire of so many people to get back. And they knew their services were going to be short. And, you know, to this day, they think that the services have been unnecessarily slow in coming in some areas, that they could have been a lot faster. But fundamentally, at least under the former Mayor Nagin, it was just laissez-faire. People just came back, got permits, and built where they could.
Like settlers. In a sense.
In some neighborhoods, very much so.
Yeah. Now, we remember, here in Detroit, we remember when former Mayor Dave Bing kind of floated a trial balloon about downsizing Detroit, and it was squelched pretty quickly and effectively. But what I don't think I knew, and a lot of us didn't know, but you bring out in your story, that he actually flew down to New Orleans to meet with then-Mayor Mitch Landrieu, and he told you he did not hold out a lot of encouragement to Dave Bing for this either.
He didn't say exactly what he said to Bing, but Mayor Landrieu did say that he had told Bing that he just didn't think it was going to work here. Mm. Now, when I discussed it with Landrieu, the mayor here, he thinks it's legally just not really possible. I mean, you have somebody who doesn't want to move. The Supreme Court has been very skeptical of eminent domain arguments in recent years, and there's a whole body of law that, you know, private property is constitutional law surrounding it. And it's just a lot harder if people aren't willing to simply move than it may seem in the design phase. That isn't to say it can't be done. I mean, a lot of planners who are highly critical of that initial planning process in New Orleans because it was not inclusive feel that are still very, very much believers in smart growth management of cities. But they just insist over and over again, you have to have buy-in. You have to have people involved in the design, people involved in the planning. Otherwise, it's just going to fall apart.
So here we have Detroit with 139 square miles with a shrunken population, shrunken tax base, and the nation's highest blight rate. And so it sounds like what Detroit could learn from New Orleans, its missteps and its successes, begins with that sense of I've got a stake. I really want to be here. And, of course, the conversation here is, will we wind up with two Detroits? Will the hipsters come in and kind of build their core neighborhoods in Midtown or downtown? But where does that leave the neighborhoods?
You hear the exact same thing down here. There's very much been parts of New Orleans are doing better than they've done in 30 years, 40 years. Restaurant scene is booming like it's never been before. Hmm. There's a big tech industry of young sort of tech entrepreneurs. And there are a lot of people in the neighborhoods that are still certainly not 100% back who talk about two different cities. And that was a big theme of the most recent mayoral election. So it doesn't go away quickly.
What do you think Detroit could learn from the racial tensions that bubbled over when that plan was? Because I'm wondering, did that help racial tensions once that resizing plan went away very quickly? Did things kind of ease? I'm sure there was ground building that had to be done by City Hall, but did it get better?
Well, it's I would say no. Mm. Part of the reason is that Mayor Nagin, who had initially, when he ran, had been sort of a candidate of the business elite, big favorite among the whites of New Orleans, saw a winning issue for reelection. Mm. And so when this plan fell apart, he ran explicitly against the plan proposed by the committee that he had himself appointed.
Oh, boy.
On an explicitly racial appeal. Mm. And that election was very, race played a high role in that, a big role in that election. And certainly didn't solve things. And, the city has a long history. It's a southern city of racial mistrust. Some of it earned, some of it has been, people live, it's a very, very integrated city in many ways. But it doesn't go away that easily. And especially with a plan like this, when it looked to so many residents like they were just, their neighborhoods were just going to get cleared away. Without any consideration of how they would have a say in the matter, that's a pretty big hurdle to get over if you think you're going to take part in the rebuilding of a city.
So, Campbell, what would you say when the title of your piece was A Lesson for Detroit in Efforts to Aid a New Orleans Devastated by Katrina? The most overriding lesson for Detroit you think would be?
Well, I know what not to do. You can't do it top down. Top down is just not going to work. I mean, I think that's the New Orleans lesson. I mean, right-sizing, quote-unquote, clearly is a tool, and it is not an awful tool on its own, but you can't wield it from the top down. Everybody's got to be involved. You've got to have neighborhood engagement. And when you get these neighborhoods really involved, I mean, New Orleans East is a part of town that I really focused on the story. They really wanted the plan. They were very eager to replan their neighborhoods. They just didn't want to be told how to do it. They wanted to be involved in it. And I think that's a lesson for any place.
Campbell Robertson's piece in the New York Times is entitled A Lesson for Detroit in Efforts to Aid a New Orleans Devastated by Katrina. It was great talking to you, Campbell. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
There's quite an excited, dare we say, happy buzz happening among the ranks of writers. The reason? Amtrak is putting together a writer's residency program, free train rides to writers. You write while you're chugging along the tracks, send out a few tweets during your travels, and let Amtrak interview at the end of the trip. So let's find out how this all came about, how it might work, and who might be eligible. Joining us now is our resident expert in all things Amtrak, Adi Tamer with the Brookings Institution. Good to have you back with us, Adi.
Yeah, great to be back.
So tell us, how did this idea even start of a writer's residency?
Right. So, we got to agree. I mean, it's just a fantastic kind of marketing program, right, that was really dreamed up by what seems like one writer across the country, but there was such a quick kind of outpouring of common sentiment for the idea. So really, the credit should go to the entire kind of journalistic community in here in the U.S. So an author named Alexander Chi emailed Amtrak to say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if writers would have the opportunity to go on specifically long-distance Amtrak trains, which, we to be transparent, Brookings is one of the first to talk about, that those trains cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
They tend to lose money too. But there is a romanticism involved with them. You know, there's something beautiful about being able to ride through the American countryside from coast to coast, north and south, east and west, and see it in the kind of incredible journey type that is riding on a train. So Amtrak, you know, and this is credit to social media of today, responded, hey, you know, let's do it. And a different author, Jessica Gross, was able to actually take the first ride between New York and Chicago round trip and was even able to get some writing done on the trip, too.
And basically, what does Amtrak get out of this? What is the writer's commitment to Amtrak?
Yeah, well, the good thing for the writer is that they don't really commit anything. It's a free ride. You know, typically, obviously, Jessica, like I mentioned, published this piece for Amtrak's website. But overall, I mean, they're writing for their own kind of current employer, right, which is often contract work. So this is just an opportunity to get a free ride. There's only kind of two confirmed cases so far, if you will, of people being able to take advantage of it, Jessica, and then the original kind of person who suggested Alexander. So we expect to see more rides. Again, since Amtrak giving it away for free, we're not sure how big the program is going to be. And evidently, we're kind of, you know, it hasn't been a jump the shark moment, if you will, but there's a lot of writers already tweeting and writing to Amtrak. So again, if there's writers listening, definitely contact Amtrak. There might be an opportunity to get a free ride across the country and even get some work done.
Adi Tomer of the Brookings Institution. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What Amtrak ride would you take if you could get a great big freebie from Amtrak? And what would you do? What would you write about? We can go to stateside at themichiganradio.org link. Share your thoughts with us. We'd love to hear what you have to say. You can always tweet us at Stateside Radio or on Facebook, Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisgetter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.